Taking a look now at the medical profession through the eyes of doctors, as they talked with Steve Bozalaki of Madison, former medical journalist for Wisconsin Public Radio and public relations director for the Wisconsin Medical Society, formerly in that position as well. He's the author of White Coat Wisdom. It's published by Apollo's Voice, and really pleased to have him back. He was with us when the book first came out a few months back. And we decided to get him back to talk more about it because we had some great comments from listeners about that interview. And certainly as we visit with him today and talk, I hope you'll join in with your questions and comments. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison at 263-1890. Steve, welcome back.
Larry, thanks a lot. Good to be here.
And you just got a 5-star rating from the Mayo Clinic.
I was really pleased about that. Pretty prestigious operation. 4 stars is outstanding, and they gave it a 5, so I think they liked the book.
They liked it a lot. Well, doctors in the book, set up this, for those who don't know about the book, tell us how the book is structured.
Sure, Larry. It's an oral history, meaning that I interviewed people and went to their homes or offices and just talked about some of the medical issues that they're most interested in. So it's verbatim. It's in their words, oral history, much like Studs Terkel did in many of his books, working, that sort of thing. I really patterned it along that. So it's divided into 10 different sections, and each section of the book deals with different issues. One, for instance, is men's health, why men don't do a very good job of taking care of themselves. The doctor in that particular chapter makes the case that men are dying prematurely of self-neglect. So he makes his case and then what he's doing about it. Another one is a former Miss Wisconsin who's a surgeon at University Hospital, and she talks about the need for organ donations and how that affected her family. So it's part biography and part medical interest that each of these extraordinary docs have.
How they got there and why it's why medicine is much more than a job.
Exactly. To them, it's a calling, and that gets into sort of the spirituality portion of the book, that there were a few things that just sort of came up. I didn't go into this book thinking I was going to interview people about religion or their spiritual ideas, but they kept bringing it up, in many cases, just because things happened that were unexplained. A patient recovered, and the surgeon says, "That wasn't me."
I didn't do it.
Wasn't me, yeah.
Oh, so there were other examples, too. There was a doctor who was rejected by many medical schools.
Yeah, he 20 medical schools rejected his application for medical school, and he said he was praying relentlessly about this. He was a very successful chiropractor, in fact, and that's why I wanted to include him in the book, because I thought that was so interesting to have someone who was a medical doctor and a chiropractor, two professions that generally don't get along very well, and this guy is both. And he just had this passion that he wanted to be a physician. He went into chiropractic only because he couldn't get into medical school, but he kept pushing and pushing, and he prayed about it, and he finally got in, and he tells his whole story, too.
Well, I guess, surgeons, they're the ones that are most directly confronted day in, day out with life and death situations.
Oh, I think that's true, Larry. Let me read just a brief excerpt from Munji Kalailu. He's a liver transplant surgeon. He practiced at UW Hospital here in Madison for many years. He has since retired and went back to Turkey, his home country. But he was telling me about a case that a woman came in from a rural community with basically a non-functioning liver. And when you have a non-functioning liver, your only option is a liver transplant. So he tells me a little bit about this. Now remember, he's from Turkey and his English isn't perfect, and this is an oral history, but it comes across fine. So he picks up where the helicopter drops off this patient. "They come here and I have no idea what's going on, but some of my surgeon friends call me in operating room and say, 'Come and look at that. I found a dead liver and we have to change right away.' And we go talk with the family. They say, 'You're kidding. She was okay. No big deal. Why did this happen?' We told them, 'Whatever happened, this patient has dead liver. They have to change.' They discuss. Finally, they accept it. But at that time, the patient's heart stopped, too. 2 hours later, they call us. 'There's a liver available. Same blood type. If not God, what is it?' I call one of the surgeons. 'We don't have time. You have to take out the liver and send it to us.' He sent it to us in 2 hours. In the meanwhile, we took the patient to the operating room. On the way from intensive care unit to operating room, the patient's heart stopped again. And then we were pumping, and an anesthesia say, 'You're crazy. You cannot do this operation. Patient is already dead.' No, we did it. I start surgery before the liver arrived to hospital. I take it out and replace with new one, and patient then go home in 11 days. You call it coincidence or miracle or God? I say God. Now, I think it's kind of an extraordinary statement. Can you imagine the level of scientific training it must require to become a transplant surgeon? And here, you know, he takes all this training and dials it down onto this one patient, but he doesn't want to take credit for it. He says something else is at work here.
Well, do other physicians, types of physicians, report experiences that they can't explain in scientific terms?
Without question. Even I had a psychiatrist, Dr. Michael Miller, and Dr. Miller is an addiction medicine specialist, so this is about as far from surgery as you can get, but spirituality comes through in his practice all the time. Here's a brief excerpt from Dr. Miller's chapter. With medicine, people think it's a science. It's not. There are so many things that we don't know that it boggles my mind. You know what, Larry? I'm reading the wrong one. This is another surgeon. Let me just finish this one. It's brief. Mm-hmm. It's another surgeon. You learn that you are not all in control. You see people come back from death's bed. Not for me. I may push a button here or there to make sure they get the electrolytes correct, blood counts. But man, I've participated in resuscitating patients who are dead, and stories I can tell you. And he went on to tell me about a case where someone died, and he was able to help resuscitate the patient. Well, while the person was quote-unquote dead, she relayed that she was speaking to somebody named Michael. And he says, well, who's Michael? Well, that's her son that we lost so many years ago, and we had this great conversation. And it made him think, again, because this isn't the first time something like that has happened to him, that there's something else going on here, greater than they are. And to hear a surgeon say, it's more than medicine. It's more, you know, medicine is more than science. I thought that was kind of interesting. But let me find the Dr. Miller. He's the surgeon, not the surgeon, he's the psychiatrist for Madison. So this is the one I was talking about. Most people in the depths of addiction have stopped praying. They think that God doesn't care about them anymore. They think that they're unhealable. But the spiritual aspect is getting connected to something bigger than me and really letting that part of you grow again. In many areas of healthcare, we're understanding the role of prayer in recovery and the role of spirit in healing from cancer, heart disease, and other things. The behavioral aspects of juvenile diabetes, coronary arteries, asthma, and a variety of conditions like Crohn's disease have been known for centuries. Most physicians and nurses are more comfortable with the bio and maybe with the psycho, but the spiritual and the social haven't maintained mainstream medicine yet. Addiction may lead the rest of medicine in this regard. And that's what he's finding, that the people, his patients, who have a connection to faith and to spirit have a better chance and are more successful at recovering. And when you think about it, emotions have been tied to our health forever. Everyone knows that. If you're a real angry person or you get upset, it affects your heart rate. Well, that's a physical thing. So it makes some amount of sense whether, you know, there actually is a spiritual being out there or not. If we believe that there is and our bodies are reacting either positively or negatively, I can see how it's going to affect you.
Absolutely. Steve Bozulaki, our guest today, author of the book White Coat Wisdom. It just got a 5-star rating by the Mayo Clinic. Doctors talk about what they do, how they got there, and why medicine is much more than a job. It's a great book. I had a chance to read the entire book, and I enjoyed it very, very much. You may have a question, or maybe you've got an experience to share yourself. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in the Madison area at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions or comments. And you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Another interesting, fascinating element of the White Coat Wisdom is end-of-life care, too. Several of the physicians in the book talk about this care and often saying that we die poorly here in the U.S.,
Yeah, I thought that was a fascinating aspect of the conversations that I've had, because medicine is really sort of a two-edged sword, Larry. You have these phenomenal technical achievements, but the question is, how far do you take this? You know, when does your quality of life mean that, you know, maybe it's better to have nature take its course? And that's really sort of the theme that I heard from, I bet, 3 or 4 people in this book, that they looked at people who had really no reasonable chance for recovery, and they're going for that last grueling round of chemotherapy. often because of the doctor that they were with. And that was their message, that, you know, patients really need to take more control and not just let their doctor decide everything for them, because it may not be in their best interest to have a feeding tube or to continue on a therapy that makes you feel terrible in your last moments of life. In fact, I went through this myself with my own father about a year ago. He was at St. Luke's Hospital suffering from heart disease, 88 years old. He had a great life. And the doctor came up to me and he said, you know, there isn't much we can do for your dad. He has blockages throughout his body. So he's on, you know, everything at that time. And he says, what do you want us to do? So, you know, these stories were sort of playing in my own head. And they were very helpful in determining how we were to make the decisions for my dad's care. And luckily, our family didn't have many disagreements. We agreed that dad wouldn't want to just exist. I mean, he wanted a quality of life. And if there was really no reasonable hope for any kind of recovery, we decided to let nature take its course. And he had a very peaceful death. And it was hard, but
sure.
I think the alternative would have been worse.
Yeah, I agree. And you mentioned doctors. I think family members can also be a kind of an obstruction to this, wanting to have mom or dad or aunt or whoever live on, even though they're not going to really have any quality.
Well, and that's really sort of the point of the book, though, the chapters in the book. Though the doctors are really careful not to, like, tell you what to think. All they're saying is, have that discussion and then do what your family member wants, because most often doctors are stuck in this impossible situation where you have, you know, one daughter saying this and a son saying the opposite, and there's nothing written from the patient. Nobody knows what to do. And in circumstances like that, they tend to just give them everything. And the irony is that, you know, we have all these kids in our country who don't have health insurance, don't even get immunizations, yet we're spending an absolute fortune on end-of-life care, these expensive machinery for people who may not even want to be subject to that.
Yeah. Well, Jerry in Ocano Falls has a comment or question. Jerry, hi.
Hi, guys. Very interesting show. I had a sister that had Down syndrome, and this is back in the late 50s, but she was over 2 years old, and she couldn't walk yet. And anyhow, my parents' physician suggested taking her to the Oral Roberts show in Green Bay at the time. And they did, and believe it or not, she walked that day.
Wow.
Wow.
That's incredible.
Yeah. So that'll almost make you a believer there, you know.
Thanks very much for calling. Well, there are things like that happen. No answer for it.
Right. I mean, and that's the challenge of medicine, because there are so many different circumstances and so many different conditions, and, you know, all physicians can do is the best that they can do with respect to what the evidence shows them in science. But beyond that, you know, that's why they're very reluctant to predict how long someone has to live, because it's some people, they'll go on 2 years longer than anybody would think. And you don't want to give someone a death sentence and convince them that they're going to die in a certain amount of time when, you know, maybe they have more.
Maybe they have more. Steve Bozalaki, our guest today, author of White Coat Wisdom. It's published by Apollo's Voice. Larry Mueller here. Jim Packard, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking about the medical profession through the eyes of doctors in Steve Buzalaki's book, White Coat Wisdom. And Judy in Reedstown is up next. So let's go to Judy. Hi, Judy. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for allowing me to. I have the flip question of this. All of the examples have been doctors that display a lot of humility and caring. And I'm just wondering if Steve Buzalaki ran into any physicians that were more like the one that I dealt with, to my loss, that were very arrogant and demanding and
sure. I understand what you're saying, Steve.
So do I. It's a great question. What I did here is I picked out doctors that I've known for years. I started out here at Wisconsin Public Radio about 25 years ago interviewing physicians. So I picked the cream of the cream. And the cream of the cream, they aren't arrogant. These are people who want to learn more. They are lifelong learners, and they're the ones I wanted to include in the book. So, no, the people that I'm including in my book aren't like that. In fact, when my sister read this book, she just read a few chapters, and she said, you know, these aren't regular doctors. I said, no, they're not. These are extraordinary doctors. That's why they're in the book. They have gone on beyond their profession. They lead various task forces. They volunteer in their community. I had a couple docs over at my house who are in the book just last week, John and Mary France. They're in their mid-80s. Mary, an internist from Monroe, is still practicing. She is on the school board. They're amazing. I mean, yeah. I told them I want to be like that when I grow up.
And there are people like, unfortunately, there are people who are, well, you know, there's a certain, to some extent, there may be a certain amount of that personality that you need, self-assurance in order to actually make it as a doctor, to get through medical school.
Oh, I think you put your finger on it, Larry. I mean, you have to be a confident person to begin with. So where's that line between confidence and arrogance? And I think sometimes doctors cross it. In fact, one of the docs in the book talks about how he dealt with a physician that he thought sort of crossed the line with respect to the care for his elderly mother. This doctor wanted to go forth with surgery. And it was life-saving surgery, but the family ultimately decided it wasn't the right thing for their mother. And they had the hardest time having this guy back off. And he said if he hadn't been a physician himself, he might have had a difficult time telling this surgeon that, no, we're not going to go that route. So it's real. What the caller talks about is real.
Thanks, Judy. Joseph in La Crosse, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Joseph.
Thank you. Good morning. I appreciate this show. I couldn't agree with your guest more. And I think people need to learn those three letters that sometimes make a big difference, and that's AMA, against medical advice. And unfortunately, I think by your guest's own admission in terms of the individuals that he worked on with this for this book, this is not the norm by any stretch of the imagination. I have a friend who recently wrote an article about his experience in dealing with end-of-life cases, and that's what he does. He's essentially like a hospice nurse. And his experience was radically different from what the general population and tone of this book is. He ran into doctors who were unwilling to be straightforward with families when there was no chance of rescue for their family victims. He ran into doctors who were like, no, we need to try everything. No, we need to do this. We need to do this. We need to do this. And were unceasing in their devotion to saving the life of a patient whose quality of life was going to be questionable, but more important, whose quality of life had passed the realm of what they wanted and what their families wanted for them. And exactly as you were just talking about, it became almost like a battle of wills in some cases that he witnessed, where physicians were not really comfortable in being straightforward and in accepting the limitations that the situation had placed on them. And yeah. I don't know if your guest is familiar with it, but they did a study at a hospital recently, and I wish I could remember where they actually took two sets of terminal patients, and they took one group, and they said, these are the people who are going to keep trying every therapy, the people who are going to keep doing anything, grasping at straws, so to speak. And the other group, they said, they built a wing to the hospital. No kidding. That worked out like a 5-star hotel. Artwork, beautiful accommodations, the family could stay with them. And the real irony of this is that the quality of life and the length of life turned out to be better for those who stopped trying to grasp at every opportunity to save themselves, and the cost was about a third of the group that was trying every life-saving potential remedy that came along.
Interesting.
I believe it. I haven't seen that particular study, but those kinds of anecdotes were relayed to me, especially by the hospice physician in the book, where, you know, her whole thing was to help people die well. They had no chance for reasonable recovery because they had a fatal form of cancer or something. And she said you would have these oncologists still saying we need to go for that last round of chemotherapy. And, you know, I try and look at it from both ways. I think it's because I'm a former reporter, Larry. You know, you try and think about everything from the other person's perspective. And what if you were trained and your whole thing was a cancer physician and you are a chemotherapy expert? You want to help your patients. That's what you do. You've spent your entire life honing those skills, and you think you can help that person. And I think that's what drives them. And I think sometimes they go over that line.
Yeah. Joy, thank you for calling. I want to give some others a chance to get on here. Lots of callers online. Appreciate your comments. And Mike in Milwaukee will give you a chance next. Thanks for calling.
If I had a doctor that was going to pull the plug for my quote-unquote quality of life, I'd get a new doctor. I think that you're really mistaken. The prize in life is life itself. That's the most valuable thing that anybody has. And to give it up because you think that the quality of life is bad might be irrelevant. It might be something that these people would rather fight for life and be uncomfortable than to do a Dr. Kevorkian, which you sound like to me, and allow them to die because you think it's proper.
Well, I don't think that's what you were talking about, but Steve, go ahead, explain yourself here.
Sure. Nobody's talking about physically, like euthanasia, I think is what you're talking about. Nobody is suggesting that. But having a feeding tube is not a natural part of life. Having extraordinary means throughout your entire span of life is not natural. What these doctors advocate is that people, the patients, decide for themselves what they want. So someone with your viewpoint, I hope you've written a living will and you've communicated your wishes to your family so they know exactly what you're talking about. That's what they're promoting, not do this or do that.
Yeah. So it's still an individual an individual's right to be able to make that decision.
It is, but it's costing society a tremendous amount of money, and I wonder how long that right will. You know, you may have that right, and then say somebody else is going to pay for it. Well, I don't know how long that can go on because the healthcare system is about to bust the way it is. Something has to change. We're spending so much money at the end of life. I think rationing decisions are going to have to be made.
Mike, thank you. Don in Milwaukee will give you a chance now. Hi, Don.
Hi, a very good program. My background is in pastoral counseling a while ago and teaching now. And there's a book by Karen Armstrong, many books on, it's called A History of God, but she's a philosopher and a theologian. And anyway, she has a line that just stopped me. She said, there's nothing that human beings can do to think being into existence. And something to reflect on.
Interesting. Well, this discussion just reminds me of something Dr. Phil Doherty said in the book. He's an internist, and he's made end-of-life care sort of his passion in recent years. And he's in his mid-70s, just a fascinating guy. Sort of reminds me of Marcus Welby, just like one of these great family doctors. So he talks to medical students about end-of-life issues. And he was saying toward the end of his career, he had about 89 patients in a nursing home. And he said when he thought about it, only two or three of them were able to even communicate in any manner. The rest of them were just connected to tubes, lying in their own feces and urine. And he thought it was the saddest thing in the world that it came down to this for so many of these people.
Yeah. Thank you, Don, for calling. Appreciate it. If you'd like to join in our conversation here as we visit with Steve Buzalaki about his book, White Coat Wisdom, give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. In the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Interesting array of comments and questions from our audience, as pretty much there always is. How many doctors, I've forgotten now, how many doctors did you interview for the book?
Well, there's several dozen represented in the book, Larry, and I tried to, you know, get people from different parts of the state, you know, geographically diverse, rural practices, urban practices, mm-hmm. different ages, men, women. I even have a couple docs from foreign countries. So I really tried to mix it up. I think that's how White Coat Wisdom is a little different than other memoir sort of books, because they're just one person's experience. And it may be a fine book, but I wanted to have a bigger snapshot, you know, the experience of many people.
And we'll take some more calls. Scott in Eau Claire, I believe, is up next. So let's go to Scott. Hi, Scott.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen. I have very strong feelings about this issue, and I think your guest is spot on. If you just give me a second, I mean, what do we really own in this life, really? And I contend it's, you know, the molecules that make up the body. And this tremendous expenditure of end of life because society, quote, says, we have a vested interest in keeping you alive. It is in the public good that we're going to overrule or trump even some of your own wishes. I really think there needs to be a change of the way we view the value of life and the nature of life. And let's really let individuals decide what they think is best and take away the stigma of people like the Hemlock Society. One last thought. Not that I'm trying to say anything about Kevorkian or his methods, but in 100 years, that guy might really have been a firebrand, even though he was weirdo, But that kind of thinking might be looked at rather positively. That's my comment.
All right. Thanks for calling. Steve, comment?
Yeah, I think Kevorkian is pretty far out of this conversation. You know, euthanasia is completely different from what anything that's discussed in the book. None of these doctors went to medical school to do that. They aren't interested in that. But what the hospice physician really taught me, Kay Hegeston from the Madison area, was saying that, you know, that there are things you can do. You can help people be comfortable in the last months of their life, you know, that they aren't going to be in tremendous pain, that they won't be fearful, that they'll be comfortable. And who could ask for more at the end of your life than that, as opposed to having sort of a uncomfortable tubes down your throat, unable to communicate, maybe not even be conscious at all. To me, it sounds like it makes some sense.
Let's go. Thanks again, Scott. Ruth in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Ruth.
Hi. I'm a nurse practitioner. And I was down in Florida with my brother and sister-in-law. He was in a hospice situation, in a hospital. And my sister-in-law was told that she should be looking for a nursing home for him. And I took one look at him and thought, this man is dying. And I said to her, have they talked to you about the stages of dying? Because it's clear to me that his body is just giving up as we sit here, you know,
watching,
waiting.
Yeah.
And as a result of this, the doctor came in and said, I'm going to do a flat plate of the abdomen. And then he came back and said, yes, he has an ileus. And I said to her, do you understand what he's saying? And she said, no. And I said, he's saying just what I was saying, that his body is closing down. And I think maybe you would better tell your kids that their dad is, really sick. Well, he died the next day, and the children were there. And I was so grateful that I had talked to them about this, because otherwise no one would have been there.
Yeah.
Brings up the importance of having advocates, you know.
And the information, you know, to give people the information that this is what I think in light of my knowledge of how the body works and everything.
Yeah,
right.
So often people are not given the information from the doctors to help them understand what's really going on, and so that they could have their family there, for example.
Yeah,
exactly. People have to really be active, proactive in their health care, and especially if it's involving an older person, you've got to have children or a family friend who is nearby and can help think through some of these things, because you can get in situations where, you know, you're thinking you have more time than you do.
Yeah. Thank you, Ruth, very much for calling with that comment. Laura in Reedstown, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Laura.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, and I'm thanking you very much for writing this book and opening the topic. I'm sorry the word Kevorkian was ever used, because this is way off again. What I wanted to say is I'm a CNA, and I take care of people at the end stages of their life. And there is a huge disconnect between the patients, their family, and the doctor caring for them, and the spirituality of a human being, the suffering they go to, the indignity that they may be experiencing. They are given very good care, and a lot of effort is made to make this a quality experience in many ways, but it seems that the dying experience is really slowed down to a really painful level for people.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
Well, it's just a medical abilities have just really outpaced our ability to absorb it socially. You know, there needs to be some way of communicating to people in their language what condition their loved one truly is in, and help them work through that and face it, and really explain, you know, what life is going to be like. And I recently, a couple years ago, pulled the plug on my brother, who was in the end stages at 40 from renal failure. And it was hard, but when the doctor said, yeah, he'll be amputated and he'll be brain damaged, but we'll save him, we knew what that saving meant. And it meant laying in a bed, waiting for someone to change you and turn you and feed you and get you up and put you back. And it's not what I wanted for my brother, and I didn't think it was what he wanted with his life.
These are just horrific situations that we're faced with. You know, as we live longer, the lifespan is increasing, and the the amount of medical care and technology, and more families are going to be confronted with these dilemmas. What do we do?
Yeah.
Is giving more care really the best care?
Yeah.
Right, and these people are cared for. It's just in a more humane, you know, instead of going through all the heroics with the pills and the therapies, that we just acknowledge, and it's called comfort measures only, where you take very good care of the patient, but you let them pass on.
Yeah.
Well, exactly. Dr. Hegestad, again, she was telling me about a little kid, a five-year-old who was dying of cancer, and I said, geez, isn't it depressing to have to work with a little kid dying like that, and when there's nothing you can do? And she said, well, there is something we can do. We can make them pain-free. We can give them treats. We can make
right.
the visits with their family. So
right.
there are things you can do. It's not. It's a horrible situation to go through, but it's not as bad as people might think.
Yeah. Well, it's hard on families to see a loved one in that condition, and they need help with that. And I think, well, however that comes about, but they need help counseling through that and loving their loved one in the final stages, mm-hmm. sitting by the sick bed, holding the hand, praying, doing what they can do to be there, you know.
Yeah. Sorry about your brother.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Laura. Thank you very much for calling. Mark in Fitchburg, we'll give you a chance. Mark, hello.
Hi, how you doing today?
Good.
I just wanted to call and say thank you very much for writing such a wonderful book.
Wow, thank you.
I survived brain cancer. I had a glioblastoma multiforme grade 4 tumor that was removed at UW Hospital. And this was in May of 2002. And I just think it's so wonderful that you write a book that tells how good doctors really can be. Not my surgeon and my doctor, nobody ever gave up on me. They're always there. They were there for questions. They were there for guidance. If one thing didn't work, they didn't say, okay, we got to try this. They led me and they answered my questions. And they were just there for me. And there's so many more doctors, like doctors in your book, than what you actually wrote about. And I've seen people a lot of times have a negative view on how doctors can be. So I just wanted to say thank you.
All right. Mark, thank you.
Well, I think he's right, and I appreciate the example. These are just some of the doctors I've come to know in my 25 years of medical journalism. There are tons and tons of great physicians out there. They may not be completely represented by the ones I've selected here, but I would venture to say most physicians are caring, competent people, and they want to do the best for their patients.
Yeah. Thank you, Mark, for calling. Marcia in Sturgeon Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Marcia.
Good morning. I'm really interested in this topic, and 3 years ago, my mother passed away. She had lymphoma. And I just feel it's very important that you have the documents in place, that you talk with your family, let them know what your wishes are, if that's possible. When my mother made the decision to end any treatment, there was a lot of discussion with the doctors and, you know, you're going against medical advice. But we really stuck to our guns, and we had the support of a wonderful social worker at the hospital who was able to kind of work with us, with the doctor, and get the doctor to finally say, okay, you do what you feel you need to do. And my mother was able to go home and die the way she wanted, and we were able to be with her. We provided her with the care she needed to make her comfortable. And I just wish that more people were able to do that, because she knew that the quality of her life was not going to improve, and that she needed to stop fighting.
Yeah, it's almost an attitude. If you have an attitude that I am going to live forever, instead of thinking that life is a journey and there's a beginning to it and there will be an end to it on this earth, maybe we all would make better decisions.
Yeah. Thank you, Marcia, very much. Frank in Heartland, your turn now. Hi, Frank.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, I got a comment from both ends of this. I'm 55, so, you know, I'm starting to look at you know, like, what do I, as I get older, what kind of care do I want? And also, I, you know, 10, 15 years ago, I went through my father, you know, having three different kinds of cancer and finally dying. And I've also been watching the, like, the way negotiations go for contracts, you know, and the way hiring and firing goes just out in our community. And I think that as we get older, we have to start thinking, those of us who want, you know, like, heroic care, when we, you know, are deathly ill, I think we're actually being immoral. I mean, I think, you know, there are people who aren't, for instance, getting jobs because more and more companies want to only hire part-time employees because they don't want to pay, you know, $15,000 a year in family health insurance. And, you know, in my father's case, you know, at first he had lung cancer and he survived for 2 years, and I'm glad he did because he got to see my son, you know, like learn to walk and things like that. But then he got brain cancer, and then he had leukemia. And, you know, and at some point, really, you know, if you're actually doing the right thing as far as the whole society goes, if you say to your family or if you write, you know, one of those living wills and say, look, you know, like, I don't want to be on any life supports anymore at my age.
Yeah, and Steve, I'll give you a chance to comment.
Either way, you make it easier on those left behind. If you don't say anything and your family doesn't know what to do, talk about making a horrible situation even worse. Tell your family what you want.
Absolutely. And I want to give Dawn in Grafton maybe a quick chance here. Dawn, hello.
Hi. I just finished up a class at UW-Milwaukee, and it was interpersonal communications with healthcare. And the professor sent us a chapter out of the book by Newland. It was called The Lessons Learned. And what he discussed was more that he started off describing why he became a doctor and started at a very young age. And he's writing this chapter up in his 70 years of age. And he talks of the riddle. And the riddle evolves around the doctors and why they do things or why they continue to search. And the riddle is that drive for doctors to continue to search. And as spoken throughout the program here, it basically states that the person's responsibility is to find those people and surround themselves with the loved ones that will make the final decision, where the doctor's position is to continue to figure out the cures and push that way so that we continue to improve in the healthcare system.
Mm-hmm. So it's more on us than them.
Thank you very much for that comment, Dawn. And Steve, thank you so much. I know you're donating a portion of your royalties to the Wisconsin Medical Society Foundation. That's great.
Thank you. In honor of Kenneth Visti Jr., he's a neurologist from Oshkosh who I came to know first here at Wisconsin Public Radio interviewing him, and then later on at the Wisconsin Medical Society. People may remember him. He was a big expert in Medicare policy, healthcare policy generally. So he saved people's lives in the office as a neurologist, but also through bigger picture things, changing laws so you can save 50 or 100,000 people. He had a tremendous influence on me, and I'm happy to dedicate the book to him.
Steve, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry. It's been a great pleasure.
Steve Bozalaki, and the book is White Coat Wisdom. It's published by Apollo's Voice. And by the way, Steve has a website. If you go to whitecoatwisdom.com, that's whitecoatwisdom.com, you can. He's got lots of great information in there about the doctors in the book, and there's some audio clips, and there's a lot there that would introduce you more to the book and what Steve's doctors had to say in it. So the book, again, White Coat Wisdom, go to whitecoatwisdom.com for another look at it. Appreciate having Steve with us. Welcome back. Coming up, we're going to take a look at the issue of foreclosures and bankruptcies with Ken Doran, Madison-based attorney. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.